extremely high degree of uniformity across the sky. But the most spectacular COBE discovery, one that won over almost all inflationary skeptics, was that the early universe was not exactly uniform. Overall, inflation made the universe extremely homogeneous, but inflation also introduced very tiny inhomogeneities, deviations from perfect uniformity. Quantum mechanics tells us that the exact time at which inflation ends is uncertain, which means that it ended at slightly different times in different regions of the sky. These tiny quantum effects were imprinted in the radiation as small deviations from perfect uniformity. Though far smaller, they are like the perturbations that rise in the water when you drop a pebble into a pond. In what is certainly among the most mind-blowing discoveries of the last few decades, COBE discovered the quantum fluctuations that were generated when the universe was roughly the size of a grain of sand, and which are ultimately the origin of you, me, galaxies, and all the structure in the universe. These initial cosmological inhomogeneities were generated when inflation was ending. They started on minuscule length scales, but were stretched by the expansion of the universe to sizes where they could seed galaxies and all other measurable structure, as the following chapter will explain. Once the discovery of these density perturbations, as these small deviations in temperature and matter density are known, was made, it was only a matter of time before they were investigated in detail. Beginning in 2001, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, WMAP, measured density perturbations with even more accuracy and on smaller angular scales. WMAP, along with telescopes at the South Pole, observed the ripples, perturbations, in the density of the radiation that encapsulates the complexity that had just begun to be created. The details of these measurements confirmed the universe's flatness, determined the total amount of dark matter, and verified the predictions of an early exponential expansion. Indeed, one of the most fabulous results from WMAP was its experimental confirmation of the inflationary paradigm. The European Space Agency launched its own satellite, the Planck mission, in May 2009 to study the perturbations in even more exquisite detail. Indeed, the satellite's results have improved the precision with which most cosmological quantities are known and helped solidify our knowledge of the early universe. One of the Planck satellite's most important accomplishments was that it pinned down one further quantity that hints at the dynamics that drove the inflationary expansion. Just as the universe is mostly homogeneous, with small perturbations that violate this homogeneity, the amplitude of perturbations in the sky is mostly independent of their spatial extent, but exhibits a small dependence on scale. The dependence on scale reflects the changing energy density of the universe at the time inflation ended. In an impressive confirmation of inflationary dynamics, WMAP and the more precise Planck satellite measured that scale dependence, determining that an early stage of rapid expansion gradually came to an end, and measuring a value that constrains inflationary dynamics. Although our understanding is far from complete, cosmologists have now established that inflation and the subsequent Big Bang expansion are part of our universe's history. We can establish these theories in detail because the early universe, with its high degree of uniformity, is relatively easy to study. Equations can be solved, and the data can be readily evaluated. However, billions of years ago, when structure formation took place, the universe changed from a relatively simple system to a far more complex one, so cosmology faces greater challenges when addressing the universe's later evolution. The distribution of the contents of the universe became more difficult to predict and interpret as structures such as stars, galaxies, and galaxy clusters were formed. Nonetheless, a great deal of information is buried in this ever-evolving structure of the universe, which observations, models, and computer power should ultimately reveal. As we'll see in the later part of the book, measuring and predicting this structure promises to teach us quite a lot, including the relevance of dark matter to our world. But for now, let's explore how this structure came about in the first place. Chapter 5. A Galaxy is Born. You might recall my dinner conversation in Munich in which Massimo, the branding expert, objected to the name Dark Matter. At that same dinner, Matt, another conference participant, to whom Massimo introduced me, inquired about people's potential for harnessing this elusive matter's power. This was an understandable question for the game designer that he was. A screenwriter friend asked the same thing shortly after, again not surprising, in light of her science fiction predilections. But this inquiry represents very wishful thinking, which I'll once again attribute to the poor choice of name. Dark matter is neither an ominous nor a munificent source of strategic power in our local neighborhood. Given the extraordinary feebleness with which known matter could possibly influence dark matter, no one can collect it in a basement or garage. With our hands and tools made from ordinary matter, we can't make dark matter missiles and we can't make dark matter traps. Finding dark matter is difficult enough. Harnessing it would be another thing altogether. Even if we could find a way to contain dark matter, it wouldn't affect us in any noticeable way, since it interacts only through gravity or through forces that have so far been too weak to detect, even by very sensitive searches. In the absence of enormous astronomical-sized objects, dark matter's influence on Earth is too small to care about. This is also why it's so hard to find. But the large amount of dark matter collected by the universe as a whole is another thing altogether. The enormous amount of dark matter that is spread throughout the universe collapsed and collected to create galaxy clusters and galaxies, and these in turn allowed for the formation of stars. Although dark matter hasn't directly influenced people or laboratory experiments, yet, in any recognizable fashion, its gravitational influence was critical to the formation of structure in the universe. And because of the large amounts concentrated in these enormous collapsed regions where matter is situated, dark matter continues to influence the motion of stars and the trajectories of galaxies today. As we will soon see, a less conventional type of dark matter that collapsed to become even denser could conceivably be influencing the trajectory of the solar system too. So even though people can't harness the force of dark matter, the far more powerful universe can. This chapter will explain dark matter's critical role in the universe's evolution and in the formation of galaxies during its known finite lifetime. The egg and the chicken. The theory of structure formation tells us how stars and galaxies developed from the extremely, but not completely, boring uniform sky that was the final legacy of inflation. A consistent picture of structure formation, like so much presented in this book, is a relatively recent advance, but this theory is now firmly grounded in cosmological developments, such as the Big Bang theory supplemented by inflation, and in better measured ingredients, such as dark matter. These underpinnings let us explain how the hot, disorderly, undifferentiated region that constituted the incipient universe developed into the galaxies and stars that we see today. Initially, the universe was hot, dense, and mostly uniform, the same at every point in space. It was also isotropic, which means it is the same in all directions. Particles interacted, appeared, and disappeared, but the density and behavior of the particles were everywhere the same. This is, of course, a very different image from the one you see when looking at pictures of the universe, or when you simply shift your gaze upward to admire the beauty of the night sky. The universe is no longer uniform. Galaxies, galaxy clusters, as well as stars, punctuate the expanse of space, staking their uneven distribution throughout the firmament. Such structures are at the heart of everything in our world, which couldn't have been created without the dense stellar systems that were essential to the formation of the heavy elements and all the amazing stuff, including life, which developed in at least one such more concentrated stellar environment. The visible structure of the universe lies in gas and in stellar systems. These congregations of stars come in a wide variety of sizes and in several different shapes. Binary stars, with one star rotating around another, constitute a stellar system, as do galaxies, which range in size from 100,000 to a trillion stars. Clusters of galaxies with 1,000 times as many stars as that are stellar systems too. To get some appreciation of the types of objects involved, let's consider typical masses and sizes for the objects that our cosmos contains. Astronomical sizes are generally measured in parsecs or light years, whereas astronomical masses are usually measured in terms of solar masses, how many suns it would take to yield the equivalent mass. Galaxies range in size from smaller than dwarf galaxies of about 10 million solar masses to the largest galaxies with about 100 trillion solar masses. The Milky Way galaxy sports a smaller, more typical size of about a trillion solar masses. This value represents its total mass, including the dominant dark matter component. Most galaxies have sizes between a few thousand and a few hundred thousand light years in diameter. Galaxy clusters, on the other hand, contain between 100 trillion and 1,000 trillion solar masses, with diameters typically on the order of 5 to 50 million light years. Clusters contain up to about 1,000 galaxies, whereas superclusters can contain 10 times that number. However, although these objects exist today, the early universe didn't contain them. The early universe was extremely dense, so it didn't yet contain stars or galaxies, which have far lower densities. Stellar systems could form only after the universe had cooled to a temperature at which it had lower average density than that of the objects that eventually formed. The formation of structure also had to wait until matter in the universe carried more energy than radiation. Note that I am using the cosmological definition of radiation, which is anything, including particles such as photons that travel at or near the speed of light. In the hot early universe, almost everything satisfied this criterion because the temperature was so high, allowing radiation to dominate the universe's energy. As the universe expanded, radiation and matter both diluted, and so too did their energy densities. Since the energy in radiation, which redshifts to lower energy, dies away more quickly, matter, after waiting 100,000 years for its turn in the spotlight, eventually came to dominate the universe's energy. At this landmark epoch, matter overtook radiation as the leading contributor to the universe's energy density. A good starting point for following how structure first grew is about this time, 100,000 years into the universe's evolution, when matter began to dominate the universe's energy. This epoch is relatively late compared to the time when perturbations first began to grow, but it is not all that long before the background radiation we observe was imprinted. Matter domination was significant for cosmology, because slowly moving matter carries far less pressure than radiation, and therefore influences the universe's expansion differently. When matter takes over, the expansion rate of the universe changes. But more important for structure formation, small, compact structures could then begin to grow. Radiation, which moves at or very near the speed of light, doesn't slow down enough to get trapped into small, gravitationally bound systems. Radiation washes out perturbations, much as wind erases ripples of sand imprinted on a beach. Matter, on the other hand, can slow down and clump together. Only slowly moving matter collapses sufficiently to form structure. This is why cosmologists sometimes say that dark matter is cold, which means that it's not hot and relativistic and doesn't act like radiation. After matter dominated the energy density of the universe, density perturbations, regions that are slightly denser or less dense than others created when inflation ended, precipitated the collapse of matter that seeded the growth of structure. These perturbations subsequently grew and transformed the initially homogeneous universe into what would ultimately be amplified into differentiated regions in the sky. The tiny variations in density at the level of less than 1 in 10,000 sufficed to create structure from a nearly homogeneous universe because it is flat, which means that it has the critical energy density that straddles the border between rapid collapse and rapid expansion. Critical density creates the sweet spot at which the universe expands slowly and lasts long enough for structure to form. In this delicately determined environment, even small density perturbations cause regions of matter to collapse, thereby initiating the formation of structure. Two competing forces contributed as this collapse into structure began. Gravity pulled matter in, while radiation, though not the dominant type of energy, pushed it out. The threshold beyond which this balance would be destroyed is known as the Jeans mass. The gas inside the region in which the outward radiation pressure doesn't balance the inward gravitational pull collapses, and the matter and the objects that grew from its attractive potential became the seeds of luminous galaxies and star formation. The regions with greater density exerted more gravitational attraction than those with lower density, thereby creating increasingly dense regions and further depleting the surrounding, already diffuser domains. The universe grew lumpier as the matter-rich regions got richer and the matter-poor domains got poorer. This aggregation of matter continued, creating gravitationally bound objects, and matter continued collapsing in a positive feedback process. Stars, galaxies, and clusters of galaxies all were created at this time by gravity's effects on the initial tiny quantum mechanical fluctuations that were created at inflation's end. Because of its immunity to radiation, and because of its greater abundance, the majority of the matter creating the attractive potential wells that pulled matter in to collapse initially was dark matter, not ordinary matter. Though we see stars and galaxies because of emitted light, dark matter is what initially attracted the visible matter to these denser regions where galaxies and subsequently stars could emerge. When a sufficiently large region collapsed, dark matter formed a roughly spherical halo, inside of which the gas of ordinary matter could cool, condense into the center, and eventually fragment into stars. Regions collapsed sooner in the presence of dark matter than would have been possible with only ordinary matter, because the greater total matter energy density allowed matter to dominate over radiation sooner. But dark matter was also important, because electromagnetic radiation initially prevented ordinary matter from developing structure on scales smaller than about 100 times the size of a galaxy. Only by hitchhiking with dark matter did galaxy-sized objects and the seeds of stars in our universe have time to form. Without dark matter initiating the collapse, stars wouldn't have reached their current population and distribution. So it's dark matter that started the collapse into structure. Not only is there more of it, but because dark matter is essentially immune to the influence of light, electromagnetic radiation could not drive it apart the way it can with ordinary matter. Dark matter thereby established the fluctuations in the matter distribution that ordinary matter responded to when radiation decoupled. Dark matter effectively gave ordinary matter a head start, paving the way for the formation of galaxies and stellar systems. Because it is immune to radiation, it could collapse even when ordinary matter could not, to form a substrate where protons and electrons could be shepherded into collapsing regions. This simultaneous collapse of dark matter and ordinary matter into visible objects such as galaxies and stars is important for structure formation and also for observations. Even though we directly see only ordinary matter, we can be pretty confident that dark matter and ordinary matter exist in the same galaxies. Since ordinary matter relied on dark matter to seed structure, ordinary matter, which came along for the ride, resides mostly in structures that contain a significant amount of dark matter, too. So, in a sense, looking under the lamppost for dark matter is appropriate. It is also worth noting that dark matter continues to play an important role today. Not only does it contribute to the gravitational attraction that keeps stars from flying away, but it also attracts back into galaxies some of the matter that is ejected by supernovae. Dark matter thereby helps retain heavy elements that are essential to further star formation, and ultimately, to life itself. Dark ages. However, although physicists can predict early structure formation based on theory, no observer can currently witness in detail the universe's transition during initial structure formation. Telescopes detect light that was emitted in more recent times, and even let us examine the earliest galaxies formed billions of years ago. The observable cosmic microwave background radiation, on the other hand, comes to us from a time when the universe was full of radiation, but when collapsed gravitationally bound objects had yet to form. The background radiation imprinted early density fluctuations for posterity 380,000 years into the universe's evolution, but it would be about another half billion years before any stars or galaxies would exist and emit observable light. The intermediate time after recombination, when neutral atoms formed and the cosmic microwave radiation was imprinted, and before luminous objects came about, was a very dark epoch that is not accessible to current observational instruments. Objects didn't emit light because stars hadn't yet formed, yet the microwave background radiation that earlier on had interacted with the ubiquitous electrically charged matter no longer lit up the sky. This time is invisible to conventional telescopes. For more details, see Figure 6 on the enhancement. Yet this is exactly the epoch when the primordial soup transformed into the progenitor structures of the rich and complex universe we can now observe. The Harvard astrophysicist Avi Loeb compares our inability with current technology to watch the earliest stars form to our inability to witness the formation of a chicken from an egg. An egg contains a gloppy soup-like structure, but let a hen sit on it long enough, and out of that egg will emerge a functioning chick that will continue to develop into a fully grown chicken. The yolk and albumen that we know about from broken eggs look nothing like what comes out, but they contain all the seeds of the chick that will emerge. But the transition happens inside the shell, so no one can see what is happening without special tools. Similarly, we will need new technology to witness the earliest formation of structure. No one can now see the dark period in the universe's evolution, though proposals are in the works. Yet we know that density perturbations, like an egg, contain the seeds of later structure. But, unlike the chicken-egg quandary, we do know what came first. Hierarchical structure. The above picture of structure formation, based on the process of individual perturbations that seed individual galaxies that then evolve independently of each other, contains much of the relevant physics of collapse. Further investigation shows that giant stars formed first, but they either quickly exploded into supernovae, releasing the first heavier elements into the universe, or they collapsed into black holes. These heavy elements play an important role in the universe's subsequent development. Only after metals, which is what astronomers call heavy elements, were present, could the smaller stars, like our sun, form in cooler, denser regions, and the structure we now observe be created. But before those stars could form, galaxies had to emerge. Indeed, galaxies were the first complex structures to exist. Galaxies, each seemingly self-contained, but as we will soon see, all connected, were in many respects the building blocks of the universe. Once formed, galaxies could merge into larger structures, like galaxy clusters. And after sufficient collapse, stars can form inside the densest regions, but the formation of the structure that we see today began with galaxies. However, this picture of galaxies forming individually is a simplification. In reality, galaxies are not isolated island universes as this picture would have you believe. Encounters and mergers with other galaxies are critical to their development. Galaxy formation is hierarchical, with smaller galaxies forming first and larger structure following. Even galaxies that appear to be isolated are surrounded by larger dark halos that are contiguous with the halos of other galaxies. Because the galaxies occupy a reasonably large fraction of space, about 1 in 1,000, galaxies collide far more often than stars, which occupy a volume more like 1 in 10 million trillion. Through mergers and other gravitational interactions, galaxies continue to influence each other. Galaxies further evolve as they continue to attract gas, stars, and dark matter into their fold. Armed with this further knowledge, let's re-examine what happens in structure formation. To better understand the process, the rich get richer and poor get poorer analogy is remarkably apt. As is discussed in today's world with increasing frequency and urgency, the poor not only become poorer, they become more numerous too. In fact, some hotly debated apocalyptic scenarios for humanity that I sometimes hear discussed predict that the rich will become crowded into small domains, edged out to the margins by the spreading of the far more populous poor societies. In this not very appealing scenario, the rich will reside on the outskirts of towns, like I saw when I visited the white suburban neighborhoods in the outer regions of Durban, South Africa. But then, continuing the analogy, neighboring towns will experience similar phenomena too. Once sufficiently spread out, the neighborhoods will collide, leaving the rich only at the intersections. The rich, segregated population might then invest in businesses and security systems, but all this development and rapid growth will be left to the nodes where the privileged classes of society crossed. Though not an attractive picture for society, this is remarkably similar to the way that structure formation in the universe proceeds. Under-dense regions expand more rapidly than the universe as a whole, whereas over-dense regions expand more slowly. As a result, the under-dense regions crowd out the over-dense ones, leaving them only on the margins of the originally expanding low-density regions. The diffuser regions get depleted and evolve into voids, and as they do so, they grow, shepherding matter into high-density sheets at the boundary. When such sheets intersect, filaments of high-density regions form. The gravitational attraction from these regions collects all the remaining wealth of matter. These increasing amounts of matter get confined to a cosmic web of thin, dense sheets enclosing voids. This cosmic web becomes a network of filaments wherein the densest matter lies at the nodes where filaments intersect. So rather than simple spherical collapse, material falls first along sheets into filaments that intersect to form nodes. A simulation appears in Figure 7 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. These nodes then seed the formation of galaxies, and this process continues over time. Structure forms and patterns repeat on increasingly larger scales. This yields a hierarchical bottom-up model, where smaller structures form before larger ones, in which small galaxies formed first. The Cosmic Web. Numerical simulations confirm these predictions on the largest scales, with dark matter correctly accounting for the density and shape of structure in the universe. Smaller scale discrepancies might be clues to further refinements of this theory, but we will leave for later a discussion of these less well-established predictions and observations and the models that might resolve them. Because ordinary matter and dark matter collapse in sync, radiation from galaxies traces dark matter-heavy regions too. In the same way that ambient light over the globe maps its cities, the brightest regions in the universe map the densest galactic regions with the largest numbers of stars. The light traces the overall mass density, much as the light map of the world traces the population density. However, we should keep in mind that, as with light, the proportion of what we see to the actual population can vary. The ratio of dark to light matter depends on whether the object is a dwarf galaxy, or a galaxy cluster, for example. Nonetheless, even with varying ratios, where there is light, there is dark, too. This is a valuable observational tool in verifying the theory of structure formation. Our Hood. Before closing this chapter and the first part of this book, let's now turn to the distribution and influence of ordinary matter within the galaxy we know best, the Milky Way, and our favorite star within it, which is the Sun. Our galaxy is named for the band of milky white light that is visible in the sky on a clear, dry night. The light arises from the cumulative light of the myriad faint disk stars that lie within the Milky Way plane. Despite the suggestive wrapping on the dark chocolate version, the Milky Way candy bar, which I quite like, and of which I have eaten too many, is named instead for the malted milkshake, whose delicious flavor the industrially produced treat is supposed to share. The Milky Way galaxy is in a group of galaxies known as the Local Group, which is a gravitationally bound system of galaxies whose density is higher than average. The Milky Way and the Andromeda galaxy, also known as M31, dominate this group's mass, but dozens of smaller galaxies belong to the group too, mostly satellites of the two bigger ones. The gravitational binding force of the Local Group prevents the Milky Way and Andromeda from receding from each other with the Hubble expansion. Their paths are actually converging, and in about 4 billion years, they will collide and merge. The Milky Way. The Milky Way has a disk of gas and stars that extends roughly 130,000 light-years across and about 2,000 light-years in the vertical direction, with this flattish land structure, yielding its distinctive shape. The disk contains stars, as well as hydrogen gas, and small solid particulate dust, and what is known as the interstellar medium, which in total has a mass about a tenth the net mass of the stars. We don't actually see the brighter concentration of light near the center of the galaxy, where most stars reside, since the interstellar dust obscures the light. Astronomers do, however, see the galaxy center in the infrared, since dust doesn't absorb this lower frequency light. The center of the Milky Way also contains a black hole of about 4 million solar masses, known sometimes as Sagittarius A. The black hole in the center and dark matter are entirely different things. However, dark matter does exist in a large spherical halo about 650,000 light-years wide. This largest component of our galaxy in terms of size and mass carries about a trillion solar masses in a roughly spherical region that encompasses the Milky Way disk. As with all galaxies, dark matter condensed first and attracted the ordinary matter that makes up what we see. A graphic illustrating this appears as Figure 8 on the enhancement. But I have yet to describe how and why a disk would form, and this will be important to the dark matter disk idea and its consequences for meteoroids, which I will discuss in detail later on. Ordinary matter is interesting in that it can have a very different distribution within a galaxy than dark matter. Dark matter forms a diffuse spherical halo, whereas ordinary matter can collapse into a disk, such as the familiar disk of stars of the Milky Way plane. Ordinary matter's interaction with electromagnetic radiation is responsible for this collapse. An important distinction between ordinary matter and dark matter is that ordinary matter can radiate. Without the radiation that leads to cooling, ordinary matter would remain as diffuse as dark matter. Actually, it would be even less dense, since its energy budget is only about one-fifth as large. However, the interactions of ordinary matter with photons allow it to dissipate energy and cool so that it can collapse into a more concentrated region, namely a disk. The energy loss via emission of photons is akin to evaporation, in which the vaporization of water carries energy away from your skin. But unlike dissipating matter, you usually don't collapse when you sweat and cool down. However, because ordinary matter can dissipate energy, gas collapses and concentrates in a smaller collapsed region in which it rises to higher density than dark matter. The reason ordinary matter lies in a disk and not a small ball is the matter's net rotation, which it inherited from the gas clouds that acquired angular momentum, momentum of rotation, in their formation. Cooling lowers resistance to collapse in one direction, but collapse in the two others is prevented, or at least lessened, by the centrifugal force of the rotation of the gas it contains. Without friction or some other force acting on it, a marble that you set in motion around a circular track will keep rolling forever. Similarly, once matter is rotating, it will keep its angular momentum until some torque acts on it, or it can dissipate angular momentum along with energy. Because angular momentum is conserved, gaseous regions cannot collapse as efficiently in the radial direction, as defined by rotation, as in the vertical one. Though matter might collapse in the direction parallel to the axis of rotation, it won't collapse in the radial direction unless angular momentum is somehow removed. This differential collapse is what gives rise to the relatively flat disk of the Milky Way, which we observe stretching across the sky. It is also what gives rise to the disks of most spiral galaxies. The Sun and the Solar System. The galaxy's net mass is dominated by dark matter, but ordinary matter, which is concentrated in the Milky Way disk, dominates the physical processes in the Milky Way plane. Although ordinary matter has only a limited role in initiating structure, with its elevated density and its nuclear and electromagnetic interactions, ordinary matter is critical to many important physical processes, including star formation. Stars are hot, dense, gravitationally bound balls of gas that are fueled by nuclear fusion. They get created in the dense gaseous regions of a galaxy. As the gas in the disk orbits around the galaxy's center, it breaks into clouds that are denser regions that can collapse further. Stars were formed out of the gas that collapsed to very high densities inside those halos. One of those gaseous balls, our sun, began 4.56 billion years ago as an energetic system in which gravity, gas pressure, magnetic fields, and rotation all played a role. Meteorites have been found that include material almost as old as the solar system, and many museums have examples. The sun is located very close to the midplane of the Milky Way disk, and is at a radius of about 27,000 light-years, farther out radially than at least three-quarters of the other stars. Like the other 100 billion stars in the Milky Way disk, the sun circles around the galaxy at a speed of about 220 kilometers per second. At this speed, it takes about 240 million years for the sun to orbit the galactic center. Since the galactic plane is less than 10 billion years old, the stars in the plane have made less than 50 revolutions in that time. It's enough time for the system to homogenize some gross features, but really it's not all that many trips around. The solar system and its formation are among the many scientific subjects where knowledge has blossomed in the last several decades. As with most stars, the sun and the solar system emerged from a giant molecular cloud of gas. Before the sun was born, everything in the solar vicinity moved rapidly, and collisions frequently occurred. After about 100,000 years, the system collapsed into a protostar, in which nuclear fusion wasn't yet occurring, and a protoplanetary disk, which is what would ultimately transmute into planets and other objects in the solar system. About 50 million years later, hydrogen began to fuse, and what we think of as our sun came into being. The sun gobbled up most of the mass from the nebular cloud, but some material remained to collect in a disk around the sun from which the planets and other solar system objects, such as comets and asteroids, would emerge. Once the energy produced by the sun resisted gravitational contraction, the solar system was born. What really caught me and my collaborators by surprise was the critical role that molecules and heavy elements play in cooling the gas sufficiently to allow for the formation of most stars. Heavy elements aren't only important for nuclear burning, they are also essential for allowing matter to cool by scattering to the point where burning is even an option. Solar-sized star formation requires extremely cool temperatures, tens of kelvins. Overly high-temperature gas never gets sufficiently concentrated to ignite nuclear burning. And yet another amazing connection between basic fundamental processes and the nature of the universe, without the complex nuclear physics that ordinary matter experiences, the gas that created the sun would never have sufficiently cooled down. Only after beginning my more recent research, which focuses on the details of astronomical systems more than my earlier particle physics work, did I truly appreciate the beauty and coherence of the universe's dynamical systems. Galaxies are formed, stars get created, and the heavy elements created by those stars and the gas they eject contribute to further star formation. Despite its appearance on human timescales, the universe and everything inside it is far from static. Not only do stars evolve, but galaxies do as well. The next part of the book focuses on the solar system and discusses asteroids, comets, impacts, as well as life's emergence and disappearance. We will see that the same pattern of interactions and changes is true, too, in our more immediate environment. Part 2. An Active Solar System. Chapter 6. Meteoroids, Meteors, and Meteorites. I was delighted when visiting the desert near Grand Junction, Colorado, to have someone lend me a pair of night vision goggles. These specially designed glasses, which are so powerful that laws currently forbid exporting them outside the United States, amplify light so that a great deal that is ordinarily too dim for human eyes becomes sufficiently illuminated to see. The military uses them to look for enemy combatants, and mountain residents employ them to find nocturnal animals. Interested in neither of these uses, I took advantage of the opportunity to look up at the sky, where I could spot objects so faint I would never have noticed them without assistance. By far the most striking thing I noticed in the clear, dry skies above was the frequency of shooting stars, small meteoroids burning up in the atmosphere. Within the span of a couple of minutes, perhaps 5 or 10 had zoomed across my field of view. I was lucky since I had looked up during a meteor shower, so the light streaks passed by even more frequently than they ordinarily would. But even without meteor showers enhancing the rate, grains of sand burn up in the atmosphere all the time. The meteors created by those grains of dust are nothing if not exciting. Magnificent light displays overhead, emanating from dust or pebbles flying by in space, radiate romance and mystery. That is, when they don't trigger thoughts of destruction. No one wants to be hit by a high-speed rock, no matter how small, and we certainly don't want a big rock to hit the Earth. Happily, although on very rare occasions objects sizable enough to do damage have hit or come close, most of the stuff that makes it anywhere near us is not cause for concern. About 50 tons of extraterrestrial material enters the Earth's atmosphere every day, carried by millions of small meteoroids, and none of us are affected in any noticeable way. The first part of this book, focused on dark matter and the universe as a whole, with a brief shout-out to the Milky Way and the solar system at the end. This part concentrates on our solar system, and especially to those objects that could be relevant in the presence of a dark disk. It explores what out there in space can come to Earth or to our vicinity, along with some key influences that astronomical features have already had on life on our planet. This chapter discusses planets, asteroids, meteors, meteoroids, and meteorites, and the confusing and frequently changing terminology that astronomy employs. The next one turns to another source of Earth-bound trajectories, comets, and the even more distant reaches of the solar system where their precursors reside. Blurry boundaries. My collaborators and I are chiefly theoretical particle physicists. This means that we study the properties of elementary particles, the basic ingredients of matter. Astronomers, on the other hand, focus their studies on the largest objects in the sky. They investigate what those objects are and how they coalesced from more elementary matter to evolve into what we see today. Particle physicists have been known to create fanciful terms or to usurp the names of people when christening as yet undiscovered, and sometimes purely hypothetical, objects, such as quarks, the Higgs boson, or axions. But our nomenclature seems downright methodical compared to most astronomy names, which often become a target of particle physicists' jokes. Emerging as they did from their historical context rather than an interpretation based in the science we now have at our disposal, astronomy's naming conventions and measuring units frequently come across today as arcane and confusingly unintuitive. The terms often are related to what was known or merely guessed at when something was discovered, rather than to our current understanding. For example, you might have thought Population 1 would be a good way to refer to the first stars in the universe, but Pop 1 already referred to one later group of stars, and Pop 2 was used for another. So, when the group of ephemeral earliest stars was hypothesized, it was called Pop 3. A comparably confusing example is the term planetary nebula, which is the end stage of a red giant star and has nothing to do with planets. Its perplexing name arose because the astronomer William Herschel misidentified the object he saw in his telescope when he first observed it in the late 18th century. Astrophysics probably has some of the most confusing terminology because people have attempted astronomical observations for centuries, with their conclusions significantly predating any theory that would correctly explain whatever the terms refer to. Only rarely at the time of discovery did anyone grasp the more complete picture, which usually would emerge only later on. Without a better understanding, the names couldn't be rooted in a valid organizing principle. The terminology used for planets, asteroids, and meteors is no exception. The original categories were overly broad, encompassing objects of very different types. Only after the discovery of new objects revealed the inappropriateness of the original terms could people figure this out. Even so, the original names usually survived, but with definitions that changed over time. I'm generally wary of name changes, which in business or politics are often used to divert attention from the real issues. However, most of the evolution of terminology in astronomy reflects true scientific advances. The exciting phenomenon that the current proliferation of terms represents is the spectacular progress that has been made over time in our understanding of the solar system. planets. In its initial incarnation, the term planet was one such liberally applied word. When the ancient Greeks first devised the term that became planet, they were unaware of the distinctions among most celestial bodies. Scientists would have needed more sophisticated measuring tools to have recognized the differences among the identical-looking spots of light on the sky. One thing that Greek astronomers could observe was that some objects moved, so they created a separate term, asteres planetae, or wandering stars, for those. But the initial definition encompassed not only planets, but the sun and the moon as well. Further discoveries called for further refinements in terminology. Though originally very inclusive, over time the term planet became increasingly restrictive. Its meaning was at first refined to refer to the five planets, aside from the Earth, which didn't qualify as a planet in a geocentric model, that are visible to the naked eye, and then later to others that were discovered with telescopes. Planets, as we now understand the term, were created after the birth of the sun, when dust grains collected increasingly large amounts of material that then collided, growing more or less into their current state over a time span of perhaps a few million to a few tens of million years, a very brief time interval from an astronomical perspective. The composition and state of a planet depends on its temperature, an important influence on asteroids and comets too. As you would expect, material accreting onto planets near the sun was a lot hotter than that collecting on planets farther out. The higher temperature kept water and methane in a gaseous state in a region that extended as far away from the sun as four times the distance of the current location of Earth, so initially only little of that material condensed there. Moreover, the sun sent out charged particles that swept away hydrogen and helium in the more local vicinity. So only robust materials that wouldn't melt at those temperatures, such as iron, nickel, aluminum, and silicates, could condense into the inner planets. Indeed, this is the material that composes the inner four terrestrial planets: Mercury, Venus, the Earth, and Mars. These elements are relatively scarce, so the inner planets needed time to grow. Collisions and mergers were essential to their achieving their current sizes, which are nonetheless small compared to those of the outer planets. Figure 9 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook contains an illustration outlining this. Farther away from the sun, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, lies the border beyond which volatile compounds like water and methane remain frozen as ices. Planets in this outer region grew larger more efficiently, since they are made from material that is far more abundant than those that make up the terrestrial planets. This included hydrogen, which they could accumulate in large amounts when they formed sufficiently quickly. Together, the four gas giant planets, as they are known, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, contain 99% of the solar system's mass, aside from the sun itself, with Jupiter, which is the closest to the dividing line where material could accumulate, carrying the bulk of it. Within the past 20 years, further planet-like objects were discovered in our outer solar system, not to mention the many others that were found in orbit about other stars. Planet was no longer a simple enough category, as the members of the group came to vary in size, from smaller than the moon to nearly big enough to generate the nuclear burning characteristic of a star. Although such revisions calling for more formal definitions have happened many times before, Ceres was a planet for 50 years after its discovery before being reclassified as an asteroid, the latest debate was recent enough that many of us paid attention to the controversy as it happened. You might remember the news stories about whether Pluto should continue to qualify as a planet. Astronomers still informally argue about the topic, and sometimes even vote to reinstate its former status. The initial debate, which was heated but somewhat arbitrary, was sparked by some relatively recent scientific discoveries. The controversy was not entirely unexpected, since people had known since the 1920s, when Pluto was first discovered, that it was weird. Its orbit is much more eccentric, elongated, than those of the other planets, and its inclination, the angle relative to the plane of the solar system, is much bigger. Pluto was also very small compared to the other distant planets in the solar system, the so-called gas and ice giants. It was clearly an oddity in the planet kingdom. But it was 70 years before several similar objects were discovered in nearby orbits that showed that wacky Pluto really wasn't all that special, and shouldn't necessarily have been singled out for planetary status in the first place. The argument for revising Pluto's categorization, in a nutshell, was something like the one that is used when formulating many arbitrary rules. If we let you in, then we have to let in everyone else. It can be a lazy argument designed to avoid more subtle demarcations, and it's rarely satisfying or convincing. But objects were found that were comparable in size and orbital location to Pluto. If Pluto were to continue as a planet, so would the one similar object named Eris that had been discovered in 2005, and most likely a few others too. Eris was particularly disturbing when measurements indicated it was about 27% heavier than Pluto. With the threat of more such discoveries looming, someone or some organization would have to decide what the mass cutoff on the lower end would be for an object to achieve planetary status. But demote Pluto, and the problem is solved. And that's what the International Astronomical Union, IAU, decided to do in their 2006 General Assembly in Prague. They followed the playbook for what people do in situations like this. They changed the rules of entry. So now, a planet is classified as an object that is round due to its own gravity and has cleared its neighborhood of smaller objects that would otherwise orbit the sun in its vicinity. That means that objects such as Pluto and Eris, which are part of belts of nearby objects that orbit nearby independently, no longer rank as planets. Objects like Mercury and Jupiter, on the other hand, are roughly spherical and isolated in their orbits. Though very different from each other, they both, therefore, qualify. This means that although many of us were born into a world with 9 solar system planets, we now live in a world with only 8. You might find this frustrating, but probably not to the extent experienced by those attending college in the United States in 1984, who were demoted from legal drinking age to underage by a change of law on July 17th of that year. Pluto was similarly demoted in 2006 when the IAU changed the planetary entry rules. Interestingly, the initial estimate of the relative sizes of Eris and Pluto turned out to be misleading. Though Eris was thought to be bigger than Pluto, the margin of error was so large that astronomers had to wait for more detailed views to verify this claim. The New Horizons spacecraft, which did an up-close flyby of Pluto in August 2014 that yielded spectacular images and more detailed information, showed the size, if not the mass, of Pluto was in fact bigger. If this ambiguity had been clear from the very beginning, Pluto might still be among the ranks of the elite. As a consolation prize, at the same meeting where planet was redefined, the IAU invented the term dwarf planet for objects like Pluto that metaphorically fell between the cracks of asteroids and planets. Pluto became the first member and the exemplar of this newly created club. The specific name dwarf planet was and is a subject of controversy, since, unlike dwarf stars, which are in fact stars, dwarf planets are not actually planets. The name, of course, arose because originally the distinction wasn't clear. The other proposed names are perhaps even more ridiculous, though, such as planetoid or sub-planet. Like planets, dwarf planets have to orbit the sun and not rotate like a moon around another planet. They are unlike asteroids in that they are not just arbitrarily shaped rocks. According to the definition, dwarf planets, which are larger than asteroids, must be massive enough to become nearly spherical under their own gravity. But dwarf planets won't have isolated orbits like true planets do. Many other objects will orbit nearby. It is only this lack of isolation, they didn't clear their vicinity, that excludes them from planetary status. An astrophysics colleague joked that planets, like senior faculty, clear nearby orbits. Dwarf planets would then be more like postdoctoral fellows, who work independently, but nonetheless have offices close to the graduate students, who, like asteroids, are less well-formed. To date, dwarf planet is a rather limited category. Pluto and Ceres, the largest object in the asteroid belt but the smallest of the known dwarf planets, are the only verified dwarf planets. Ceres is furthermore the only one in the inner solar system. The farther out objects, Haumea, Makemake, and Eris, are also officially recognized, since they are sufficiently big that they are almost certainly fairly spherical, although their shape has yet to be reliably observed. Other candidates are likely to fit the bill too, such as the mysterious object Sedna, but we will only know after better measurements are completed. However, many astronomers think there are more, perhaps as many as 100 or 200 dwarf planets contained in the distant Kuiper Belt, which we'll turn to soon. The Kuiper Belt is probably where the objects mentioned above originated, and very likely the source of many more of a similar type yet to be discovered. Asteroids. As opposed to planet and dwarf planet, the term asteroid remains a bit vague and colloquial, since the astronomical societies never formally defined it. Even up to the middle of the 19th century, the words asteroid and planet were used interchangeably and were usually taken to be synonymous. When we use the term asteroid today, it generally refers to an object that is bigger than a meteoroid but smaller than a planet, encompassing objects in the inner solar system whose sizes range from tens of meters across to almost 1,000 kilometers. As the appropriately named New Yorker writer Jonathan Blitzer described them, asteroids are the solar system's most veteran castaways, rocky bodies in orbit around the sun, left over from the formation of the solar system. Too small to be planets, too big to be ignored, they can reveal a great deal about our primordial history. Unlike dwarf planets, asteroids are usually irregularly shaped. This can be seen in Figure 10 on the enhancement. The low upper limit to the observed rotation rate of asteroids leads scientists to suspect that most are not tightly bound objects, but are merely accumulations of debris, since rubble would fly apart if rotation speeds were higher. Support for this conjecture comes from spacecraft that have visited asteroids and a few observations of asteroid moons, both of which argue for low asteroid density. Asteroids are not in short supply. There are probably billions, and they vary widely in their composition. Most are either stony asteroids of the S type, which are made of ordinary silicate rocks that are found mostly near Mars, or they are C type, carbon-rich, which are mostly found nearer to Jupiter. The latter receive particular attention when people consider life's origins in the solar system, since carbon is critical to life as we know it. Intriguingly, laboratory studies of meteorites demonstrate that some asteroids contain tiny amounts of amino acids, making them even more interesting from this perspective. In the next chapter, we will see that this is also true of comets, making them another important topic when considering life's origins, which I too will do later on. Water, too, is a key component of life, and some asteroids contain water, though comets generally contain more. Metallic asteroids, composed primarily of iron and nickel, exist too, but are rarer, only a few percent of the asteroid population. Though at least one relatively well-studied asteroid has a nickel-iron core and a basaltic crust. As opposed to planets, asteroids are rarely alone. They orbit in specific regions in the solar system, accompanied by many others circulating nearby. Most are located in the asteroid belt, which extends from Mars to the region that includes Jupiter's orbit, spanning the outer edge of the region of terrestrial rocky planets interior to the frozen gas objects farther out. See the illustration in Figure 11 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. The belt extends from about 2 AU to 4 AU, roughly 250 million kilometers from the Sun to about 600 million kilometers away. Outside the main belt, the orbits of Trojans, another category of asteroids, are tied to that of a larger planet or a moon, ensuring their steadiness over time. Distribution of asteroids. A lot of progress has been made in the science of the asteroid belt's formation, starting in the 2000s, when astronomers began to understand planetary migration in the early solar system. We now know that a few million years after planets began to form, charged particles ejected by the Sun eliminated most of the remaining gas and dust from the disk. Formation of the planets then ended, but not that of the solar system. Planets moved after this time, sometimes very disruptively, scattering material out of the solar system altogether or moving smaller objects around. One of the significant research advances in planetary science of the last few decades is an appreciation and recognition of the role this planet migration played in forming the solar system as we now know it. The gas planets moved most significantly, affecting the development of asteroids and comets. The inner planets also migrated inward, but only a bit, and therefore probably played less of a role. It's likely that a large number of asteroids were sent into the inner solar system when disrupted by several of the outer planets' motion outwards and Jupiter's move inward, beginning an event known as the Late Heavy Bombardment, which occurred about 4 billion years ago, about 500 million years after the solar system's formation. The heavy cratering on the Moon and Mercury from these impacts provides evidence for this event. Astronomers think that asteroids are remnants